Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, August the 21st, 2001. In the fireside room this evening is Judy Wojtaszek, and today's session is number two in the sequence and is titled Triangle of Tragedy. Let's listen in.
And I don't want to do that. This session is called the Holocaust Triangle, and there's a reason for that, but to set the tone for it, I'm going to, and some people are probably going to get sick of me showing or reading what some of my students have done, but this was a story one of my students had written last year in response to their culmination activity after we had read Night and done the Holocaust. She entitled it Sunrise, Sunset. When you've been stripped of your life and forced to live in someone else's plan, the world you once knew along with your memories of the world slowly fade away. And it's odd because you don't really notice at first. Then all of a sudden it just occurs to you that you can't remember a time when life wasn't so painful, a time when life wasn't so helpless and hopeless. My most vivid memory, almost my only memory, is of the sunrise. Every morning, I would slowly climb the hill behind my family's house and sit against a tree, my tree. I would close my eyes and breathe in deeply the cold, wet morning air, waiting to feel the familiar, tender touch of warmth against my cheek. My mouth would curl up in a smile, and I would open my eyes to see the first flickers of sunshine, darting into the air, casting the sky into the most beautiful shades of orange and pink. As I watched the sun slowly take its place in the sky, I would be filled with such an overwhelming feeling of tranquility and happiness, I thought that perhaps I might be able to fly if I tried. Afterward, I would make my way down the hill, slipping on patches of dew and feeling light as a butterfly. Now, I feel as if I have the weight of 10 elephants on my shoulders. I am no longer Hadassah, Jewish citizen of Poland, 16-year-old daughter of Yamitz and Yair, sister of Beverly and Jaser, human being. I am prisoner number TT5563, and I have no rights. I sit on a small bench in the northeastern corner of the sorting house. I'm not sure what camp I'm in. I don't think I even care. Although I believe the camp is near a central loading area because of all the bags of luggage brought to the sorting house every day, you can never be sure how the Germans set things up. There are prisoners working in other parts of the building, emptying suitcases, sorting through their contents, mending shoes and clothes. They throw all of the pictures and other Jewish items like menorahs and candles into a big truck to be brought to the furnace. Yesterday, one of the women in my camp found a picture that she had taken of her children and brought with her in her luggage. She put it in her shirt. Somehow, the guards found out about it and shot her. My job is to examine the jewelry that they find and separate the fake from the real. I have never seen such big stones in my life. I pick up a large ruby and slowly run my fingers over its smooth surface before looking at it under a lighted glass. Fake. A guard blows his whistle and yells at us to come and hurry up. I turn off the light on the glass and quickly walk over to the line of prisoners forming at the door. I feel a hand rest against my back and I turn around. My mother stands behind me. We are not allowed to speak. We talk with our eyes for a second, and then I turn around, my eyes shifting to the ground where they've grown so accustomed to looking. Walking down the dirt road, our hands tucked in our shirts in an attempt to not feel so cold. Almost everyone is in our group, all women, turns their head to the side to see if they can catch a glimpse of a husband or a son behind the barbed wire fence in one of the men's camps. I thought I saw my father once. but now I think my mind is just playing tricks. The two things which seem to occupy our minds the most are staying warm and eating. They give us old, thin shoes once used by other prisoners. We wear torn pants and shirts or tattered dresses. We don't have coats or mittens. When I first got to the camp many months ago, the cold bothered me a lot. The cold penetrates your skin and slowly permeates through your body, digging into your bones and leaving you feeling as if you can never be warm again. It's an everlasting cold that leaves you feeling numb. We turn left and walk into the camp. The SS officer orders us to form a line. I stand next to my mother and I glimpse into her sad, tired eyes before turning my face to the ground. We stand for what seems like an hour. The SS talk to each other and glance back at us. Every once in a while, there is no reason for us to stand. They just want us to suffer. But suffer for what? I ask myself this question a lot, it seems. What have we all done that is so horrible that we deserve to be treated so inhumanely? Are we not human beings? Are we not created by the same God which created the Germans and everyone else in the world? There are no answers to that question, or any of the questions I seek. Finally, the guard blows his whistle and we are allowed to go into our bunks. We have nothing to do. I sit on my bunk with my mother sitting next to me. Others do the same and talk quietly to each other. A whistle blows and we all jump up, run outside and form a line again. It seems petty how we are so afraid of them and jump at their every command when we outnumber them greatly. But how are we supposed to behave? They hold our lives in their hands. Their hands, which are so eager to kill and punish. How could we not be afraid? This time we stand for a reason. We march up to the serving table and each takes our ration of bread and soup. The bread is hard and the soup is dark and runny, but to us it tastes delicious. I try to eat slowly, but it seems impossible when you're so hungry. I eat my bread in two bites. Soup makes me feel warm and drowsy. We are allowed to go back into our bunks. My mother and I share a bunk, which, by the way, is unusual. If you read any of the documentation, most of the people shared three or four to a bunk across this way, and they were three high. So she was allowed to sleep just with her mother. But remember, this is fiction written by a student, a 10th grade student, based upon the novel Night and her own research. Sometimes at night we tell stories about our families, or we talk about the liberation, which people swear is coming soon, but everyone seems to be very tired tonight. We all just walk in and climb into our bunks. After a few minutes, the room becomes filled with the whispers of people praying. My mother holds my hand and prays aloud. She thanks God that we have lived through another day, that we have each other, and ask him to help stop our suffering. She says the same things every night. Praying seems to give us some hope and comfort, but it doesn't free us from these awful camps. All our prayers are unanswered. The room gradually becomes quiet, and I say goodnight to Mother before closing my eyes. I drift in and out of sleep, shivering and hugging my arms and legs to my chest to stay warm. I can feel her tossing and turning all through the night. Her stomach has pained her since we were brought here and they took my brothers away. She often talks about seeing them soon, but in her heart she knows she won't. They were very young, too young to be of any use to the Germans. I tell my mother that she has an ulcer and needs medicine. She says she's fine. I have no strength to argue with her. I awake the next morning to the sound of the capo, blowing his whistle and yelling at us to get up, you lazy pigs. I feel like I haven't slept at all. We stand in line and quietly eat our bread before they start marching us to the sorting house. It's so cold. Clouds of breath form in front of my face as I walk. As we walk past one of the men's camps, we see the men lined up being forced to watch a hanging. And if you've read The Night, this is one of the very powerful points of it, is when the true, the, and that's where she got this, of course, when someone has done something wrong, as simple as maybe stealing a piece of bread, they are hung on display in front of the rest of the camp, and they all have to march back by them. They always make us watch. They say, let this be an example to you of what will happen if you disobey. I close my eyes and turn away from the scene. The person to the left of me, one of the older women in our group, suddenly stumbles on a rock and falls to the ground. I try to grab and drag her up before the officer gets to her, but I don't have enough strength. Please, she says to the officer, I think I twisted my ankle. If you could just... The officer cuts her off. Stand up, you lazy old woman. I can't. My... Shut up, he yells and grabs her arm, dragging her to the side of the road. Please, she cries despairingly. I'm sorry, I'm fine now. Please, no, no, I'll... He shoots her in the head and walks back to the road. He blows his whistle and we turn our heads to the ground and start marching again. I work all day sorting through rings and necklaces with inscriptions like, to my wife, my world, and my soul, or your love is a gift I'll cherish always. There was a golden locket with a picture of two little girls inside with the inscription saying, my darling, dear angels. These things make me want to cry and scream at the world. Who would let innocent, beautiful children be taken away from their mothers and be killed and thrown into deep, blazing trenches? We go back to the camp at the end of the day. We're given our rations, and then we go to our bunks. There's yelling outside. We run out and form a line. Heimel, the head of the camp, is here. I stand very, very worried. Having Heimel around means no good. He talks and laughs with the other officers before turning around and walking toward us, hands behind his back, eyes gazing back and forth between our eyes. I shake with fear. He starts at one end, making the way down the line. He glares into people's eyes and pulls at their clothing, looking them up and down. Halfway through, he pulls out a lighter and a cigar, lights the cigar, and sticks it in his mouth. He moves up to an old woman, the oldest in our work group. He stares into her eyes. She stares straight ahead. He smirks and slowly takes the cigar out of his mouth and blows a puff directly into her face. She tries to ignore it, but the smoke must irritate her eyes and nose, and she suddenly sneezes all over him. We all flinch and hold our breath. The officer grabs and yanks her out of line. It's obvious he wanted her to sneeze and give him an excuse to punish her, as if they think they ever need an excuse anymore. She says nothing as he forces her to kneel on the ground and put her hands over her head. He puts the gun to her head and holds it there for a minute before telling her to get up. She stands up, surprised. He points to the line and she starts walking back, relief washing over her face. She gets within 2 feet of the line before he shoots her and she falls down onto the ground, blood spattering all over the ground, providing a bright contrast to the dirty white earth. The women in front of her body gasp and we all freeze in terror. He walks over, steps over her body, bends down and puts a cigar out in her cheek before continuing down the line. When he gets to me, I am so scared I'm afraid I'll faint, but I know I mustn't. He pinches at my arms and legs a bit before shaking his head. He stares into my eyes and mumbles to himself, what a pity, before moving on to the next person. He finally finishes and we are allowed to go back to our bunks. As we are all lying in bed, someone starts singing a song. And this is one of the other things you find out if you read that novel. Very early in the novel, you find that this is what people did at night. They sang songs. And it's a lot, if you have listened to any of the presentations of the five famous women, that's what a lot of people did that were in this type of situation. They were downtrodden. They would sing at night to give themselves some strength. And the Jewish people did the same thing. I turn to my side and close my eyes to try and stop the tears that are coming, but I can't. I don't want to read all of this, but I wanted to get to the end. They're taken as a small group I was thrown into before, and it's now turned into a large group. We look around at each other, confused. The guard walks over and orders us to start marching, and we march in silence, looking around us, wondering where we're going. Then the chambers come into sight, and it becomes clear. The group erupts with the sound of moaning and crying. I grasp at my mother's naked body and start crying. She hugs me but doesn't know how to comfort me when she is so scared herself. As I walk to my death looking around for someone to help save us, my eyes catch the sunset. The sun is almost below the horizon, and for a moment, just a flicker of a moment, I am cast back at home, back to watching the sunrise on the hill. The colors are beautiful, so beautiful. The sun sends the sky into an array of magnificent colors, transforming the dull blue. I can't stop myself from smiling. For a moment, I'm not afraid to die. There's more to the story. But I wanted to give you that as a setting to try and understand. What I call the Holocaust triangle. The victims are in the middle. Now, in this case, what I have been talking about is the Jewish Holocaust, but you can take any Holocaust that has occurred since. Whether you're talking about Bosnia or some of the countries in Africa, same thing is true. In the middle are the victims, and completely enclosing the victims are the rescuers, the bystanders, and the perpetrators. I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time on the perpetrators because I think we know a lot about them. But I am going to go into the others just a little, but keep that in mind. This might be a little hard. There we go. Okay. The victims, as I mentioned yesterday, and if you've read the book, they were blind to the warnings that were there. As we looked at the things that were coming along in those different years, as I listed them, they really didn't pay attention. Their rights were being taken away, but it didn't seem to have an immediate effect. So the victims closed their eyes to that. As things developed, they came up with this, which appears repeatedly in the novel. It appears in my students' paper. And this is probably the most compelling question that anyone in the center of this triangle has to say is, where is God? Why is he letting this happen? And this is true of these victims. As far as who they were, ages, it hit every age. The children, the elderly, the teens, the parents, made no difference. And there were 6 million of them that were Jews, 5 million of them fell into the other categories I mentioned before, which were the gypsies, the Jehovah Witnesses, political prisoners, homosexuals, and handicapped Germans. They, particularly Hitler, had the idea that they should have the pure Aryan race. And the only way he was going to get that is to get rid of what he called all this trash. And so these were the victims during this time. The perpetrators, of course, the one we know most famously is Adolf Hitler, who came up with the final plan. But remember, actually admitting to his final plan never happened until 1942. The plan was actually devised in 1933. There was the SS, the Youth Movement, and the Green Police. The Youth Movement was very, very strong among the Germans. It was very easy to pull in the young people and have them support it because they belonged to a group. It was their patriotic duty. They had pride in what they were doing. And that was a nice, strong core for them. Now, I put in here Hungarian police because it pertains to the novel Night. But it was whatever country he was dealing with, he would use those people that were the police or the military body in that country to perpetrate upon his victims. He would use them to pull in those who were gypsies or those who were Jewish hiding in those countries. So he knew the first thing he needed to do was to have the military on his side from the countries that he was moving into. And this, so they fall into the category of the perpetrators. The next one that is really kind of hard for us to understand, because we would say, no way would our religious groups help become perpetrators. But they did. The Judernat, which was the Jewish council in a community, they ran the community. The rabbi was a real strong part of that, but there were also a number of other people that served on the Jewish council. What they did to help perpetrate all of this Holocaust, how and enforce it, was they would get the ruling down from Hitler, from the Germans. The Jews must wear stars. The Jews must give up all jewelry. The Jews must give up their property. And who enforced it? It was very sly thinking on his part. He was a mastermind. The Judernat would enforce it. And they would convince their people, this is in your best interest. Nothing else will happen to us. Nothing's going to happen to us if we just do what they ask. Now, to make it more enticing, even than that to them, there are some that have been interviewed after the war that admitted, because they could hardly live with it, they admitted the fact that they did what they were asked because their families were guaranteed protection. And maybe you would do the same thing. You've got to think about that. This was particularly strong in the ghetto, and I'll be doing some things with the ghetto tomorrow and the next day, but the Jewish leaders ran the ghetto, and the military would come in with the orders, with the new rulings. When they first formed the ghetto, it was real loose, and they could run it the way they wanted to. And if you know anything about the Jewish people at all, they run a very tight community. They take care of their own as far as social services are concerned. They're very strong in their beliefs as far as education are concerned. And so when they were even put into the ghettos, they formed their own schools. They were told they couldn't have schools, so they would have them in groups of 15 children in a room at somebody's house, and the teachers would come in, teach and move on. So they handled all that themselves. So, you know, really, what were they losing when they were in the ghetto? That's what they thought. They're so much better off than dying. As I mentioned before, often the purpose was just to keep themselves out of prison as far as the Judernats are concerned. Now we have the bystanders. I'm going to talk about those on Friday. The Poles, that's referring to this book, but anyone within the countries where these Jewish people were made victims, the religious and the rest of the world, like the United States closing their doors. Most of the doors of various foreign countries were closed for deportees or for immigration for Jewish people. So those are bystanders. The rescuers, the righteous, and the liberation troops. Those are the obvious ones, the liberation troops. They're the ones, the Allied forces that came in and said, okay, we've taken this land back. You know, you're free now. These were, and you talk to anyone who served in the liberation forces, and they have a hard time talking about coming into these camps and seeing these people. And of course, they thought the first thing, because they were just so starved, you've seen pictures of them, what do we do with them? Oh, we've got to feed them. We've got to put something in their mouths. Well, can you do that? Give them a couple of candy bars. Many people went into shock. Their systems went into shock, and they died before they ever left the camps, because nobody knew how to treat them when they moved in. So as far as the liberation troops, their intentions were very good, and they did free them. The righteous is another whole group, and we're going to be able to do it. The righteous is a group of people who are not Jewish, that many times were in the same area, whether it was Poland or Holland or France or Italy, and they did things for the Jewish people. They helped to hide them. They helped to feed them. They'd give them money to move on to other places. They might give them forged documents. Now, the Jewish people have recognized a lot of these people. And in Yad Vashem, where I had studied, they have what they call the Avenue of the Righteous. And it's quite a long stretch, I don't know, 4 or 5 blocks. And what they have done is they have planted trees in honor of each person who has been recognized as a righteous. And they have to be, oh, it's a real complicated process to do it. You fill out their name, you have to explain why and what they did, specifically for a long period of time for the Jewish people. But they do recognize without those righteous, many of these people never would have survived. Bonhoeffer has a tree there, I saw.
Is this prior to liberation?
No, this was after. Oh, no, just a minute. I misunderstood your question. They came up with the Avenue of the Righteous after. This is helping them
right.
Before liberation.
Right.
It's even helping them before concentration camps.
Right.
People who stood alongside as the trains came through, and they knew that there were starving people on the trains who were headed for Auschwitz or Majdanek or one of those camps. And some people, you know, even with the threat of soldiers standing there with guns, would throw loaves of bread into the cattle cars. You can't document that, so they wouldn't fall into the righteous as far as being recognized, but we certainly have to accept the fact that people took an action to help them. That's all on here that I want to talk about. Leading into this film, and what I had just finished talking about as far as the righteous was concerned, this book I had mentioned before, it's called On Both Sides of the Wall. We don't have it here, and I don't think we've got it in the library. You have to go to your own public library, and then you might have trouble finding it. You can get it from the Smithsonian Institute. They have them at their library. And it's written by Ben and Black Hamid. And these were the two directors of the program that I took. These two were ghetto fighters during the uprising in Poland at the ghettos, particularly the Warsaw Ghetto. And they wrote a book about what they had seen, what they had gone through, some of their experiences, and I'll go into some of those later. But in the introduction to this book, I had remembered one line, so today I'm thumbing through trying to find it. It's at the very end. The introduction was written by Elie Wiesel. He knows them very well. Well, at the end of it, he says, "No, hang on, kid," they used to say in the ghetto, "and suddenly it becomes clear whom we should pity." And this is what I think is really important. Everyone. And even more, not for the victims, it is too late for pity, but for humanity. For with open eyes, it betrayed, and itself, it betrayed as well. Which I think is very, very true. In the video I want to show you, I think we'll get through the whole thing. This is a community in France. Now, who knows what happened to France? Were they occupied by the Germans? Yes.
Yes.
When they were initially occupied, what happened? Who ran their country?
The Vichy.
They were allowed, right? They were allowed, just as I was showing you, they were allowed to run their own. But then eventually, the Germans were running. This small community decided, they were a Christian community, nobody there was Jewish, but they made a decision as to what they were going to do and how they were going to do it. And I think it's an excellent example of the righteous, that corner of the triangle that we're talking about. Would you take the cap off of that, please?
Thank you. It's on fast forward.
It's still on fast forward?
Yeah.
Finally.
We're all backtracked.
The children.
Tell me when I'm here, I can't see the screen.
But that's
this one.
We're all off.
Who's that?
People of all ages.
I wanted to start at the beginning so you can. You don't need to see all the credits for channel name.
No, totally screen.
Now that it says play, so it's.
There are you get some.
I guess we'll watch the credits for channel one.
Thank you.
In 1940, France fell to the Nazis in less than 6 weeks. The Germans divided the country in two and occupied the northern half. In the southern zone, also known as the Free Zone, France had a new leader, Marshal Philippe Pétain, the venerated 84-year-old hero of World War I. From his capital in the town of Vichy, Pétain urged collaboration with Nazi occupiers. The existence of the Vichy government was a convenient arrangement for the Nazis, and the French were allowed to continue administering all of France. Throughout the century of the rise of European anti-Semitism, many European Jews had fled to Paris. By 1940, nearly half of France's 350,000 Jews were foreign-born. The Western world, including the United States, had slammed its doors on the threat of Jews. France, the traditional land of asylum, had been the last refuge. Roundups began in broad daylight in 1941 in the streets of Paris. It was French police who performed these roundups.
You notice, use the local government and the local military.
Mass arrests and mass deportations began in the summer of 1942. Smuggled a camera to the internment camp of Lissat in unoccupied southern France. He took these pictures of the beginning of a deportation to the north and then to Auschwitz. In all, France was to contribute more than 75,000 Jews, including 10,000 children, to the nearly 6 million European Jews tortured and murdered by the Nazis while the world stood by. In 1940, Madame Bauer was running a pension, a boarding home, for school children and summer visitors. The guests in need were never turned away. During the next 4 years, there would be many guests in need.
Vous savez, c'était tellement naturellement, on ne comprend pas qu'on fasse plein d'histoires autour. Ça, c'était tout simplement. Moi, j'en avais pas tellement. J'en avais pas trop vite, en général. Ils arrivaient à faire minuit, 1h du matin, les trains n'étaient pas normaux du tout. Ils dormaient par terre, ils dormaient comme ils pouvaient, s'ils ne pouvaient pas autrement. Nous avons tous les deux souvent donné notre fille quand il n'y avait pas autre chose, quand il n'y avait plus rien pour elle. Je l'ai dit simplement parce qu'il y avait besoin d'être aimé. Cet accueil qui venait beaucoup de ce que les gens croyaient encore en quelque chose. dans la Bible, il est écrit de donner à manger celui qui a faim, de visiter celui qui est malade. C'est une chose normale.
The Chambon was in the initially unoccupied southern zone, 350 miles south of Paris. The village was part of an isolated plateau nestled in the mountains of south-central France. This was a poor farming community used to struggling through long and rugged winters. These were hill people used to centuries of perseverance as a religious minority. At the time of World War II, most of the peasants and villagers in the area were the descendants of Huguenots, the first Protestants in Catholic France. Once, because of their belief, their temples had been destroyed, their lives abolished, their men deported to Ceylon Valley, their women interned in towers where they left messages for future generations. Resist. Once, itinerant preachers had risked their lives reading psalms from the Old Testament and identifying their biblical journey to the Promised Land. This period is known as Huguenot history as the desert. It lasted for 100 years. While many Huguenots fled abroad, the people here clung to their land and their beliefs. For the people of the Chambon, the memory of their past was the very key to survival. Nothing that occurred here during the war years was to seem entirely unfamiliar. And in every challenge, there would be an echo of their forefathers' struggle and faith. refused the French Jew, joined Lucy, a Jewish organization committed to rescuing Jewish children. She would make a round of the farm on the Carson Plateau, looking for hiding places for these children. Later reported herself, she survived Bergen-Belsen concentration camp.
Les derniers savaient ce que c'était. Mais on ne leur disait pas. C'était une manière de les protéger que de ne pas leur dire ce sont des enfants. Les petits se plaçaient plus facilement parce que les petits c'est gentil, les petits ça mange pas beaucoup, parce que les petits ça n'attend pas. Et on a toujours eu beaucoup plus mal à passer les grands. Et je me rappelle d'un type qui s'appelait pour Thiago. Et il me restait sur les bras deux gosses de 14 ans. Et personne n'en voulait parce que c'est trop, oh, ça reste tout seul. Ça m'en voulait. Et je les vois encore.
It now became a village of children. A Swiss relief agency for children successively set up three new homes in or near Chambord. At least a quarter of the children were Jewish, while others were being spared the food shortages and bombing raids of war-torn France. In the deceased, the first of these homes, most of the boarders were foreign Jews, many of whom had been gotten out of France in internment camps for centuries of time. The three Swiss homes in Neuchâtel became havens of song and faith, peace and solidarity.
Nous savions que l'Ancien Testament, c'était des Juifs.
Among the most welcoming to Jews were the area's many Christian fundamentalists, who did not recognize the authority of the clergy and sought to live as best they could, according to scripture. Mahimoth is one of these Christians. Mahi and the Omwat themselves found food and shelter for a stream of refugees. At first, Le Chambon's defiance had been of its own government. But in November 1942, after the Allies landed in North Africa, the German army swept across France's demarcation line and occupied the southern zone. The people of Le Chambon and their Jewish friends were now directly under the Nazi spotlight. The Germans came to Le Chambon. The German army took over two hotels in the middle of the village for soldiers convalescing from the Russian front. The Germans set up their headquarters right opposite the headquarters of the armed resistance in Le Chambon.
Chez nous, la porte qui donne derrière la maison était toujours et très souvent, je ne sais pas qui bougeait la maison. Et la porte devant, à vue d'œil de l'hôtel d'Union où les Allemands étaient encore dans les
ouais, oui.
Mais les Allemands devaient être au courant de ce qui se passait dans aux ombrages de leur fenêtre.
Je pense pas, je suis pas sûr que ça les intéresse.
Non.
Parce qu'ils étaient convalescents et ils étaient probablement bien contents d'avoir acheté du moment qu'on ne les embêtait pas et que les gens n'étaient pas. Les gens étaient froids mais pas désagréables. On se contentait quand ils venaient jouer sur la place de rentrer dans les maisons.
False identity cards, false ration cards, were essential for life in hiding under the Nazi occupation. Le Chambon became essential for the manufacture and distribution of false papers. For the fall of 1942, a teenager had arrived with some very useful skills. He had learned to become a forger. Born of Skalosowski, he is remembered in the village as Jean-Claude Prune. Osowski is now a family doctor.
Moi, j'apportais une technique. C'est notre production de faux papiers atteignait régulièrement des papiers pour 50 personnes par semaine.
50
alors, ah oui, c'était une activité. Pratiquement, on passait nos journées à fabriquer les papiers et nos nuits à les distribuer.
All this took place in what was then the home of Henri et Emma Héritier. The Héritiers are peasants. Both their families have lived in the area of Le Chambon for generations. During the Nazi occupation, they shared their home with Jewish refugees. They didn't know that one of them would involve them in one of the most highly punishable of crimes.
Les faux papiers, vous êtes rendu compte quand
on se prend. On va faire après, parce que moi, je vais demander que les affaires accrochées, je vais vous montrer quelques points.
Notice where it hides.
Je me dis bien, pas les laisser traîner par là. Je ne crois pas qu'il y a un contrôle de cette chose dans ce domaine. Mais là, on va être comme moi.
Qu'est-ce que vous avez fait?
On est là pour faire.
C'est
là. Au revoir. C'est pas des hommages, il y en a un chacun, par exemple.
Et c'est difficile, il fallait mettre la main dans les bouches pour les...
Ah oui, on dirait le pas de belle, mais enfin bon.
Est-ce que vous ne créez pas des inquiétudes?
Non, on n'a jamais eu d'histoire, jamais personne n'a rien demandé.
Et vous saviez qu'il était juif?
Ouais.
Oui.
Ouais, on n'en a pas parlé, là. On va aller
on ne parlait jamais.
Government documents reveal that the Vichy authorities did nail down that the distribution of false papers was going on in the Chambord, and that the village had become a key starting point for illegal border crossings into Switzerland. Yet somehow, the activity kept on growing, as Jews continued to pour into the area till the very end of the war. Some Jews remained virtually in hiding throughout their stay in the area of the Chambord. Others derived a sense of security from passing as Gentiles, or imagined they were passing as Gentiles. A few were Orthodox Jews. Madame Magali Kuhn and her family kept kosher throughout their stay in the area. She remembers her equally committed Christian neighbors.
Il s'est trouvé qu'un jour, j'ai été invité par la famille d'héritiers qui habitait à la Bruyère à assister à l'office protestant. Je n'ai pas refusé. Il savait très bien que j'y venais en tant que juive. Les paysans étaient très contents que je sois venu à cet office. Mais je leur ai expliqué qu'il n'était pas question pour moi de venir régulièrement, étant donné que ça ne m'apportait pas ce dont j'avais besoin. Et ils m'ont très bien compris.
Et ont respecté beaucoup.
Et ont respecté beaucoup. Nous craignions bien sûr à chaque instant d'être attrapés par les Allemands. Nous étions sur l'équilibre pendant toute la période où nous étions. Et lorsque j'ai quitté le Chambon, lorsque j'ai quitté les sachets, en décembre 1944, j'avais toujours encore l'espoir que mon mari me viendrait. Il a passé la chambre à gaz le 25 janvier 1944. Mais je l'ai su longtemps après. J'ai un frère qui a été déporté en 1943 également, père de 3 enfants, une belle-sœur qui a été déportée en janvier 1944, très proches, qui ont été déportées avec mari et enfant, une tante. Ils ont très grande partie de leur famille.
Combien en sont revenus?
Aucun.
The Holocaust occurred in the heart of Christian Europe and would not have been possible without the apathy or complicity of most Christians and without the virulent tradition of anti-Semitism that has long infested the very soul of Christianity. And yet, here, under the Nazi occupation, Jewish religious services were held during the High Holy Days and Hanukkah, with the help of devout Christians. Pastor Edouard Fitz, assistant pastor of the Chambord during the war.
Si vous deviez résumer la foi chrétienne en une phrase,
oh ben c'est Jésus qui l'a fait en disant, tu aimeras le Seigneur ton Dieu de tout ton cœur, tout. Que ton âme, toute ta pensée, et ton prochain comme toi-même. Voilà le résumé.
What was the characteristic common of all those people who helped out?
They did it because it had to be done.
Because it had to be done, that's one thing. What else?
They were loving.
They were loving, definitely. They felt that that was their part of being a Christian, of caring about God. Was there anything that you thought was unusual about that? A community?
They were all similar in their belief.
Yes, even though they may not have all been from the same faith. Their basic belief and the reason for doing things were all similar. Anything else?
They didn't seem to worry about getting caught.
And why do you think that is?
I don't know. I thought about that, you know, during the film, that nobody seemed to be afraid at all.
Well, what did the rest of you think? Why?
They didn't seem to have a turn-in mentality. Nobody seemed to. I don't know why. They were open, so obviously they weren't too worried about their neighbors.
Don't forget, too, they're talking to you after this was done. During the time period when it was done, they may have been very afraid.
Done they what?
They may have been very afraid and worried.
That's true. That's true. And like I said, this was made about 18 years ago.
Yeah.
Well, I think most things in life get down to either love or fear. And these people were doing it for love. And in our own lives, most everything gets down to love or fear. And that's what Jesus said. The perfect love casts out fear. These people were very clear. It was about love. Maybe it was retrospect. But
no, I think you're right. And I think at the time, because they thought they needed to do it out of love for their neighbor, they didn't think about the consequences.
Right.
You know, I don't think that came up. Any other reactions to that? That is an excellent example of that section of the triangle called the righteous. And you didn't find it just in this isolated village up there in France. You found it in Holland. You found it some in Italy. You found them in England. You found people in Poland who did this. The Polish were much more afraid. And they had a stronger fear of what would happen to them. And I personally think part of that is because they knew that some of these camps had been built. They never admitted it, but they knew it. And so the fear was stronger. They knew that if they were caught doing some of these things, they would find themselves there also. Any other final comments? We're going to get out of here by 20 after. Yeah.
I have a question. As you mentioned, there were places all over where they sheltered Jews.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you mentioned that there were many other groups getting persecuted. Did they shelter them too?
No.
No.
They didn't. They let those people go without really showing much care about them, whether they were the gypsies or the homosexuals or the handicapped or political prisoners. They were just, that was a part of the war in their minds. And it's kind of funny because in here it talks a lot about humanity. And if you remember what I read at the very end here, it's a pity not for the victims but for humanity. And it's almost like that group of people that you're asking about, those five other groups, didn't fit into what was generally accepted across the board as humanity.
Right. Well, and when America came in, we left homosexuals to burn. We did not free the homosexuals.
Yeah. Well, look at the attitude even today. So,
yeah.
Any other comments or questions? Okay, thank you very much for surviving the fire practice.
Thank you.
And tomorrow morning, if you want to come join me, we'll be talking about, we'll see some slides on some of the ghettos.
Is it tomorrow morning?
Isn't it tomorrow morning at 10:45?
What?
I think so.
No, I don't think so.
No, I thought that was going on.
It isn't? Well, I don't know. Check the kiosk. I got to go check it.
I think you're on it.
I'm at 10:45. I don't think we're opposite each other.
And so is Mike.
Right.
Good.
Two others.
Because I missed one of hers already.
Yeah, I don't.
I don't.
I would
be at the
compound.
Yeah.
What are you going to do?
I want to go on that hike thing that they have today.
Good. Well, thank you all for coming.
Thank you. Good question, David.
Yes, very good question. I appreciate it. And you know what? One of the hardest things to do is to see people
pass by.
Yep.
I wonder, have you ever heard of Stonewall?
Yes, I have. In fact,
heard of what?
Stone Soup.
Stone Soup.
I may even have a short story.
students. Any of those kind of stuff.
We can have a lot of them.
Yeah. But there, you know, there's some really neat stories. Do I look at what? The girl that wrote this text would be the second in 20 years Jewish girl I had in class. Never says a word. Brilliant student. She's a great student. I have never had any problem with her. But she probably even takes the Stone Soup magazine. I didn't realize there was one.
Now it's a very neat magazine. You see, yes, it's by young writers and artists. You see, what they do is they send in their works and submit them to
the
magazine.
She may have submitted it to it, for all I know. One of these poems is one that I read by Danny Brown, a student of mine. She did submit hers to publication.
Cool.
So
they just send them in the magazine, and they have poems, book reviews, and stories fully illustrated by another person.